Hi, I'm Tom Talpe from Microsoft. Glad to be back here. I've been coming to SOMBXP for quite some time. Let's see, how to introduce. This talk was gonna be about something that I'm working on lately called durable remote memory. But then I was informed that I'm the keynote. So here I am, and I'm gonna open up the topic. I've decided to open up the topic. I hope I'm not too far out of line. Some of these are my opinion. Some of these are Microsoft activities that are currently going. I'm not sure that everybody at Microsoft will agree with what I'm about to say, but I'm pretty sure they'll agree. But I want to talk about three things first before I do the other one, and I'll try to fit it all into my allotted time. But first, things that we have delivered. You know, Samba and Microsoft have worked together for, well, longer than I've been working for Microsoft. I joined in 2009. I've been coming to SOMBXP since 2010, I guess, was my first. Maybe I was here in 2009, I don't think so. Because I joined in June and SOMBXP was in May. So anyway, things that together we've delivered, things that together we're developing, and things that we need to further discuss. All right, so I'll spend about half the time on that. And then the other half, I'm going to talk about durable remote memory, which is a personal favorite and a personal quest that I'm pursuing and have talked about here before, Berlin. Last year I talked about it. But all these topics, I hope, may lead to our continued collaboration. Really, that's my goal here today, to motivate that collaboration that we've been doing so successfully, and I hope will continue. So, first, delivered. SMB3 from both Microsoft and Samba. Pure review, SMB3 is the key storage protocol for Windows interoperability, storage interoperability. It's used by virtually all key Windows services in one way or another. It's supported with, obviously, Windows to Windows, with SQL Server, with Office, you know, any host of Windows enterprise applications. The three main servers that I'll identify are Windows itself, right? Windows both client and server SKUs support both client and server roles. That's not a surprise at all. But they use it for file and block storage services, and they use it with RDMA, an advanced interconnect that I'm proud to say I had a part in. It's high performance, it's enterprise quality. With SMB 3.0 and our latest 3.1.1, it supports full continuous availability. So it's grown into this enterprise storage role that has caused broad adoption across the industry and across applications. In particular, it's grown outside of Windows. And it's grown into Azure, Microsoft Azure, our cloud offering, where we support SMB 3.0 as the Azure file service. It's primarily for the benefit of virtual machines, guests running in the cloud, and their applications, right? Those applications are traditional, file-oriented Unix and Windows applications. They open files, they read and write files. But running it at scale, running it safely, is the challenge in the cloud, and SMB 3.0 has been the solution. And finally, the third major leg of the triangle is Samba with its 3.1.1 server. It's a file service including rich related enterprise features. Samba, thanks to our collaboration, I hope, and thanks to Samba's ingenuity, have implemented many of the protocols, a surprising number of the protocols, in the SMB family, which have improved its success for both of us. As well, their clients, of course. I'll just list the two big ones, I think. Windows, obviously, and Samba's Linux client, the 3.1.1 support. That last one is going to play a big role in this motivation. Samba Windows Interrupt. Samba interrupts pretty much perfectly with Windows, right? The Samba server works with SMB clients. It serves Windows SMB clients. And the Samba client works with Windows SMB servers. There are some features that are slow to appear in the Samba client, But that's okay. They're appearing over time, and I'll talk a little bit about what Microsoft is doing to help that. But Windows is now only one aspect of the SMB3 world, as I mentioned. So the emerging presence is SMB3 in the cloud. Linux guests are the dominant presence in the Azure cloud. Most of our guests run Linux. We provision them automatically, like one, you know, a credit card for a few dollars and a couple of clicks, and boom, you have a Linux instance running in the cloud. They are by far and away the dominant presence, so they motivate a large part of our business, right? We're linked closely with those Linux guests. The Azure File Service, as I mentioned, supports the application file access running on those guests. So to access Azure Files, the Linux SIF client requires a few things that it sort of has that could do better. And I'm just going to mention them here quickly. A robust, persistent handle recovery. All handles in the cloud are persistent, right? Cloud services migrate around like crazy. Failures happen, rerouting happens, partitioning, you know, migration of the VM, of the guest VM happens. So handles must be persistent in the cloud. And a robust recovery of those handles is required in the client. Scalable performance at cloud service latencies. The cloud is a large thing, right? The latency from client to server is higher than you'll find in this typical data center. It requires parallel operation. It requires robust algorithms to deal with widely varying latencies. The storage latencies themselves are greater, right? You don't generally get direct access to hardware in the cloud. True POSIX semantics, finally, true POSIX semantics are expected by applications, by these Linux applications. And SMB3 and the Azure Files need to carry those semantics across the wire. So that last one is kind of the challenge, the big challenge. There's a strong desire to close these gaps, to allow Linux to be a fully performant member of the cloud. So Azure Files, you've seen these before perhaps, but I'll just re-mention it here. Net use the cloud is David Goebbels, our principal on the Azure Files project, the server side. It's an SMB 3.0 service on cloud port 445. It's real SMB service. It's backed by the cloud blob store instead of by a file system, but it provides all the file system semantics that SMB 3 exposes. It's largely in support of cloud Windows and Linux guests. So it serves both Windows and Linux. And there's a couple links there. You notice they're subtly different. Storage.net, how to use files, right? With the .NET API for Windows. Actually, it's broader than Windows. It's now open source. But it's primarily viewed as a Windows application today. And Storage, how to use files Linux is a separate tutorial on how to configure a Linux system to access Azure Files. They have some really interesting details in them and some interesting comments from users. I'd recommend reading them. They tell you a little bit about how to deploy it. Windows guests largely work, obviously, as you'd expect. The Windows implementation is rich and complete and supports the Azure requirements well. Linux guests, some assemblies required. There's a few glitches, but it works. We pre-configure many of the Linux guests. But the SMB3 readiness for POSIX in the Linux client and others is problematic for some apps. Linux apps typically require a POSIX environment, right? And the SMB3 trueness, if you will, to POSIX is incomplete. So we've talked about that before, and I'm going to talk about it here. And I just want to mention, NFS support in the cloud is a popular request. It's a logical request. NFS is a POSIX-like file system, remote file system. But, you know, we've at Microsoft have made a commitment to SMB3. And so it would pain me greatly if we had to ship an NFS offering in order to satisfy this. There's better reasons to ship an NFS offering. So I will throw this down as a little bit of a challenge to the Samba team, right? And oh, by the way, SMB1 based attacks are increasing. we're being pecked to death by sparrows. So these attacks are actually quite serious. It's fast approaching the time to go beyond deprecation. We've been deprecating SMB1 for two releases. And we already leave SMB1 off by default in many Windows SKUs. Our nano SKU and server core and things like that turn it off by default. It's only our retail SKUs that turn it on by default right now. We really, really are getting hammered with security issues with SMB1. There are so many attack vectors, and we have so little reason to continue to support it. I'm just going to say the writing is getting much more clear on the wall that we have to turn this off. So I believe it's also time for Samba and Microsoft to discuss this again as a result. We've discussed it before. It's a hard problem. There are a lot of legacy systems that depend on it. But really, we have to do something. We absolutely have to do something. I'll point out we can do something different between server and client. Turning it off in a server has different implications than turning it off as a client. And so we may want to look at those things separately. But I would love to see Samba drop SMB1 support in a future system, in a future server system. And the client, I'd love to see SIFS.ko become a SMB1 legacy subsystem and to see a new innovation in an SMB3.ko. And I'll motivate what some of the aspects of that I think are. So one other thing that we're doing, we've delivered in this space, is the Microsoft Linux offerings. There's a thing called Linux Integration Services. This is KY Srinivasan's team, and we've talked about this in many open source forums. KY, for a while, was the top submitter to the Linux kernel because of the volume of code that was in these so-called enlightenment drivers. But these basically enable efficient guests on Hyper-V, right? They're fully paravirtualized drivers for things like networking, graphics, et cetera, that allow for efficient Linux guests to run on Windows under Hyper-V. A second thing that's shipping more recently, within the last year, is this thing called HV Socket, the Hyper-V Socket. It's an efficient, secure guest access to the Hyper-V host partition. It allows the guest to open a socket to its local host and communicate efficiently to that host instead of paravirtualizing a network driver just for loopback purposes. It has a new socket type called Hyper-V. It uses some odd names with GUIDs and the like, so it's clearly a different name. There's an interesting little tutorial there that I link. I just want to bring your attention to these. These are a couple things that we do in the Linux integration services area, the integration. It's not limited to Linux. It's also FreeBSD. I'm not sure how Samba could specifically leverage these features, but I think they would be very interesting to discuss. And obviously, these things are available in the cloud as well, although the cloud has different parameters, restrictions around them. So things we're developing, there's a couple of interesting things here that I want to talk about. The first, you've probably seen this. This has been around for a couple of Windows releases now, but we call it LSW, the Linux Subsystem for Windows. It's literally Ubuntu on Windows, literally. I shouldn't put quotes around it. They use the actual Xenial Ubuntu binaries on a modified kernel, right? It's 4.4 based. It uses the Windows personality support to emulate system calls. It's not a virtualization solution per se. It has its roots in the former NT POSIX system and the system for Unix or system Unix, I forget what A stood for, but SUA, SFU. Basically, it's a personality that traps a system call and emulates it using local facilities within the Windows kernel. It is not strictly virtualization. That's where the modified kernel comes from. It exposes local NTFS file systems. So you can use it to, cruise around your local disk drive and open files and work on them. But you can only do your local disk drive, right? It has to be an NTFS local disk drive. It sort of runs in a very close compartment. relationship to Samba. Well, you can APT install Samba. You can literally APT install Samba on this thing. And I'll show you a little screenshot, which mostly works. The server kind of has a problem, though, because it wants to open 445, and Windows already has 445. And the privileges are a little odd. You run this whole thing under a user, so you can get, quote, root privileges in the Samba, in the LSW subsystem, but you don't have admin privileges on Windows. So a few things act a little strange. And client issues, there's the little matter of kernel module support. If it's a custom kernel and it doesn't have the sifs.ko, well, that's a little awkward. So I'll show you a couple things. I first installed the client. I did an APT install sifsutils, which would seemingly be enough. And it installed quite a bit of stuff. I was rather surprised by that. A whole lot of Python, a whole lot of strange other things. But, it was only, 56 megabytes or whatever, and it all installed just fine. Unfortunately, when I tried to mount a file system, I had a little problem. The sifs.ko wasn't present. I'm sure that's a solvable problem, but it's not there by default, so that will be a slight issue. I thought it was such a helpful thing to say, go read the man page right there in the error output of the mount command, but what the heck. The Samba server was a little more successful. Having installed the sifs utils, I didn't have to install a bunch of things that had already come in, but they all came in just fine. Running the service actually started, and it runs just great. I think James Kane made this same observation last year at the SDC and various other places. But you notice those two highlighted things. Port 445 was not available, and the socket permission denied was returned. So, there are some odd things going on. You can vector it to a different port, and it will work just fine. Yeah, sure, Jeremy. The user space client probably would have worked. I did not. Yeah.
The other thing that would be really cool to see on a Windows desktop is if you are running the standard Ubuntu graphical packages, is that you should be able to bring up the file manager and browse to remote SMB shares using the libSMB client library and user space that's built into the GNOME file system browser.
Yeah.
And so I think that probably would have worked.
I think it would have.
You could have shown browsing to Windows shares from a Linux client running on a Windows desktop. Sorry, this is just breaking my head.
It's a little crazy, isn't it? Yeah, you could even browse the local. I mean, if you ran an SMB server on the laptop, you could browse the local disk via SMB. That's where I'm going to go in a minute, though. Okay. So, no, I didn't show user space. I'm not a user space kind of a guy. I do hack phones with C# and .NET, but that doesn't really count. Samba Linux subsystem for Windows opportunities. I just want to put the question out there. Are there any opportunities for Samba in the above? Does it make sense to use Samba in a Linux on Windows environment? I can't help but think that there must be. But I just want to ask that question. I think the question is slightly different, as before, between the server and the client. And I'm interested in your feedback. These are just my thoughts on a couple of aspects.
I can certainly see it, because Samba is using its VFS. It's so infinitely flexible. You can do things that probably will be very difficult on NTFS, and just redirect to network drives or re-export network drives or do some cloud stuff and yeah, there's
re-export network drives. That's a scary thought. Okay.
Yeah, but people do that.
Yes.
We don't like it, but people do that.
So Tom, I actually know of a use case for Samba running on Windows Server, because this was something that someone did maybe 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody ported Samba to be a Windows service.
Yep.
They disabled the Windows SMB server. And the reason they wanted to do that was they had some kind of CD jukebox tower that they wanted to export. And there was something that the Windows server wouldn't do. mm-hmm. that they were able to do with Samba. And they were much more comfortable running on a Windows platform. So they ported Samba to Windows, they ran it, they exported their jukebox, and they sold a product that was basically Samba on Windows.
Great.
So it would be really easy for them to do that using this. So.
The concern that I would have with that would be disabling the SMB service on Windows has many implications. As I said, SMB is a key framework, transport subsystem on Windows. And turning it off, just so we can take over file service, has many other implications outside of the file service. Yes. Well, in a constrained environment, I think it could work.
So I actually tried, doing this last year or so.
Yep.
And I actually ran it and, got SMB client to connect and everything. One of the problems that I actually found was that, the port 445, you could have it on a different port. But you couldn't access it through Windows.
Right.
You couldn't access it through the Windows Explorer, for instance. You could, redirect it through a VM and get it on port 445 on some different interface, for instance. But, that's a whole bunch of, okay. And net use, for instance, didn't work on anything
I'm
but
sorry,
445.
I'm sorry, I've just been given the 10 minutes signal.
Yeah.
So I'm going to have to accelerate.
So, yes, just one other thing. So I think one really interesting opportunity between Samba and in that space is actually interoperable, is actually for developers, and actually having, people want particular environments so that they can do, they want something SMB when they're doing their development trees and stuff like that.
Okay, great.
Not strictly related to Samba, but you could really export NTFS via NFS now that you have Linux running there.
Correct. SMB Direct. This is probably news to you. Microsoft is prototyping SMB Direct support for Linux. Long Lee, who's sitting in the back rather quietly, has been working on this for some time. At the moment, it's client only. We're not considering doing a server implementation, but he's gotten rather far with it. It has a few simplifying initial principles. Connections are made via RDMA directly. It's not a TCP connection followed by multi-channel. It's just straight to RDMA. Second, send receive transfers only for now. No direct data placement via read and write. It does, however, do transfers up to 1 megabyte because the SMB Direct lower layer has a fragmentation capability. The initial implementation connects and negotiates SMB 3.1.1 between Linux client and Windows server over RDMA, and it transfers data rather successfully. Currently, it fails when doing a sustained file copy. Right? It sits there cruising along for a long time, and then all of a sudden, the server detects a MID out of range. I think that's coming from the Samba client. I don't think that's Long's fault, but it might be something in the transport that's allowing a few extra messages to leak out. In any event, Long is very interested in getting some insight on this. Steve.
So this is kernel client?
Kernel client.
Awesome. Let's merge it. We got 2 weeks.
Let's
get it
merge
in.
It.
No, I mean,
might be a little early for that,
yeah,
Steve.
I'm half serious, though, that at this point, a lot of what we need, even experimental code that's disabled, right, even experimental stuff, as long as there's ways for developers to test it. Because this idea of enlightened transports and RDMA is, there's an enablement cost in both client and server.
Mm-hmm.
And being somewhat aggressive about merging experimental stuff into things that are disabled, I don't want to suggest that we're defaulting everywhere here to this. This is extremely exciting.
Yep.
So the bottom line is that this is that you're talking about the kernel client. That was my main clarification. And second of all, this is something we haven't documented, I don't think, right? The idea that you can go to Windows and only use RDMA.
Actually, it's documented, but only in the passive sense. The protocol document refers to the way Windows connects to Windows, which is always via TCP followed by RDMA. But there's no prohibition against connecting via RDMA directly. So, I'm forced as a protocol documentation, legally compliant person to describe only what Windows actually does. I can't hypothesize about other possibilities, but here we are.
Yeah, I mean, this is really neat. And I think, as we've talked about before, 10 years ago, we talked about how exciting this kind of stuff was, and you saw the VirtIO and VirtFS work. Here, we actually have reality.
Yep. Well, so I was thrilled by that. Okay, so in the interest of time, I'm going to drop one of my topics, and I'm just going to spend the rest of it on this last one, discussions. Unix POSIX extensions. Okay? Now, we've talked about this before, but that first sentence, it's the key to tying this all together. It is absolutely the key at this time to tie it all together. For Linux guests to run in the cloud, for Linux guests to run on Windows, for POSIX applications to run on those Linux guests, we want this SMB3 infrastructure that we've built to carry it. And if they are not there, NFS may well have that opportunity instead, which would be a big shame, in my opinion. So the POSIX extensions are long overdue. Rhetorical question, do we have sufficient understanding of the requirements? Can we move from requirements to a protocol? Whatever the answer to that, it's time to move forward or give it up. I noticed. Just a brief history, for those who may not be aware, years ago there were SMB1 extensions written in the SNIA. Back in 2002 they were published. In 2010, I and others created the SMB2 Unix Extensions Project. This project has I talked about it at SNIA Storage Developers Conference. There you are. I was surprised that it was back in 2010, but I guess not too surprised. There's a whole project structure there. It's hosted on a website that Chris Hertel actually owns and maintains for us. Desperately in need of some content, by the way, but yeah, it's still there. There have been 6 years of discussion. There are many valid reasons for the delay, but it's probably time. In the meantime, we've had some Apple extensions and some other extensions proposed. They may be part of this discussion, but the goal is a single standard, you know, possibly an extensible standard, but definitely a single standard. I just mentioned a couple whiteboards found on Tom's phone from 2015 and 2016. The list pretty much fit on a single board each time. The list is not that long, and I believe that over time we've sharpened that list. Jeremy has definitely been given some good hard thought to it. There are a lot of voices to be heard and a lot of corner cases to be thought through, but it's not a huge task. Are we ready to write it down? Could we do it next month in June at the Redmond Plugfest that Microsoft is hosting? Could we do it? Well, maybe. Actually, I have to leave tomorrow. Could we talk about it this fall at the SMB Plugfest, co-located with Storage Developers Conference? That gives us two opportunities in just a few months.
Excuse me? For the STC, I did create a proposal for, as we had last year, a session on this. I'll add you as a co-author.
Oh, at SDC. Oh, right. Okay.
But I want to be careful. What I put there was as a follow-up for anything we did wrong in the standard, right? So basically, if we can close it in June, and SDC allows people to throw rocks at it and say, no, you did this wrong.
Okay. Great.
So panel discussion at SDC.
Panel discussion. All right, I'm up for it.
Yeah, for people to tell us what we did wrong in version one of it that we implemented next month.
We've already mentioned that the lights are still on at unixsmb2.org. That name is fairly carefully crafted, by the way. The SMB2 was back in 2010, remember. SMB2 was the tip of the spear. Now it's SMB3. Well, you know, we have a domain called Unix SMB2, and the protocols SMB2 and 3, and I don't know. But one way or another, the lights are still on. There's a very important project structure there that allows for the open sharing of information in a way that certainly Microsoft and other companies are comfortable with consuming it. I mean, there's a real risk when you have an open standard that there's intellectual property hiding in that standard, right? So we need some structure around that so that corporations can participate. It's pretty lightweight, but it's probably worth revisiting prior to actually sharing too much information and writing it down. Other than that, we are ready. I've been given a small extra extension, so I'm going to go through this really fast and just come to the end. But I want to talk about something that's near and dear to my heart called durability. It revolves around a new technology called persistent memory. I talked about this last year in Berlin at SambXP. So some of this is review, and I hope I can just accelerate through it. But persistent memory is a new hunk of hardware that's going to be present on most server motherboards. You can buy it today on a lot of server motherboards. There are file systems emerging to sit on top of it. This stuff behaves like storage, but it has memory latency. It's amazing. There is also a desire to have RDMA access to it so that it can work remotely. And there are some new APIs emerging, some new file systems emerging around it. Windows supports persistent memory out of the box since last fall. Your laptop has a driver on it called SCM Bus, an SCM disk. SCM stands for storage class memory, and that's supported on Windows out of the box. It's also supported on Linux. I'll just mention Windows here in these slides. JEDEC define NVDIMN. You slap one on your motherboard. If the motherboard recognizes it, Windows will too. There are four different access methods: direct access file system, block mode, a persistent RAM disk, application interfaces such as mapped files and the NVM programming library, or finally, you can have an open coded application. If you really, really, really want to get down and dirty on the Intel processor, Orange Book or whatever, go for it. You can open code this thing. I don't recommend that. Direct access architecture. The interesting thing about the architecture is that green curvy line at the far right. The application can open the file using the file system, but then can map the file and bypass the whole I/O stack. It's doing loads and stores directly to persistent memory. I/O in DAX mode is memory mapped. It also supports cached access. In cached mode, it's actually faster than non-cached mode. You normally think of cached mode as being the slower of the two. Non-cached mode, however, just turns into cached mode as a result. They provide the same semantic. That's an interesting thing. It does the same thing on Linux, to my understanding. And finally, we have block mode volumes. So that's all backward compatibility. But the performance is really shocking. You can see a 10x jump between each of these things, roughly, right? Maybe not quite 10x on that last one. But an NVMe solid state device is a fast device. It's NVMe, it plugs into the PCI Express bus. But it's block mode, it has a latency, and it has a maximum throughput. These were real numbers. This is single thread, single core, okay? We're looking for latency here. But, 15,000 IOPS, 14-something thousand IOPS. We get about 10x that by moving to a block mode NVDIMM through the RAM disk driver. And we get over 1 million IOPS, same application, same platform, when we go to fully mapped mode. Pretty shocking. So that's the compelling story that we want to tell. DAX appears in Linux today. There's another file system that I'm personally really interested in called Nova from the University of California, San Diego, Steve Swanson's team. There's a website there. They have an implementation. They talked about it FAST last year. FAST last year. I think they also had a presentation this year. I wasn't able to attend FAST. There's significant industry convergence around these facilities for persistent memory. And where it gets interesting to us as SMB developers is going remote. One local copy of storage isn't storage at all. It's just temp data, right? It could go away tomorrow. It could go away in a few seconds if your VM migrates away from the machine that owns the disk. So enterprise-grade storage requires replication in a multi-device quorum-oriented way. So we need remote access, and we want to preserve that latency story. We want to have a single-digit microsecond remote latency goal. We want to use RDMA to do it. Well, we need a few guarantees in the RDMA protocol for durability. We can actually layer some of these things on top, but this is what I've been very active on. I'm not going to spend time on it now, but there are some very simple extensions that are quite far along in the process that I believe will light this up. We don't, however, need the extensions just yet. There are ways to use them, to use this facility without those extensions. RDMA-aware storage protocols use RDMA, SMB3 and SMB Direct, obviously. As NFS RDMA uses it, and I want to mention that a fellow named Christoph Helvig, that I'm sure many of you are familiar with, a Linux developer, is about to propose a future parallel NFS RDMA layout, very similar in concept to this. So you'll see at least two well-known file system, remote file systems move this way. And there are many other ways to use it. NVMe can be directly accessed over PCI Express bars, bus address registers, right? You can map a PCIe device, treat it like memory. Anything that can be memory registered and accessed via RDMA is eligible for this type of access. So really, don't just think file system. Think other types of access, like block. And this is my little example that shows a picture of three ways to write a file. From the SMB server, IO requests to the file system. From the SMB3 server, loads and stores to a mapped version of the file. And from the RDMA adapter directly, right? And so those are my three modes, traditional IO, DAX memcopy, mapped file memcopy, and push mode, directly from the RDMA NIC. And all three of these things are possible today. Number three, however, requires an extension to really be perfect. It's almost perfect. You can read and write the data. You just can't commit the data without the extension. You don't get that guarantee of durability. I've talked about that before, so I won't go into it again. But the near future, to wrap up, I would love to see Samba support DAX on Linux, a mapped file on a persistent memory device. It could be as simple as solution one above, where it's just traditional I/O, it just happens to be a DAX file on the back end. I'll bet that is easy. I'll bet you could do that today, right? But you get the benefit of that low latency, basically RAM disk, behind the device. Persistent, right? You have to be a little careful about commit. You have to do commit, you know? Do a flush every once in a while. You probably already do, but it's worth checking. Second, ideally, with read-write access via memory-mapped file, instead of launching an I/O down the stack, do a memcopy. Map it and do a memcopy. A few more issues there. You need a lot of virtual address space. You need to manage it carefully. You need to commit it with a flush instruction. But it's not that much harder. I think it's easily doable. And you get the benefit of no I/Os going up and down the file system stack. And eventually, via push mode RDMA, where you enable an RDMA side channel, if you will, to this same region of memory. It's potentially simple, one FS control and some leasing rules. I've talked about this at the SDC. But that's kind of a three-step process to a really brave new world of low latency storage. That's it.